And I think it's totally true that you end up odd if you're homeschooled. Odd can play out in a lot of positive ways. I mean,
hello everybody. That was Josh Hanum, CEO of Interact, and a super young CEO. But I'm pretty sure I scarred him at the start of the conversation by making a porn reference, not realizing this is, in, you know, open mouth insert foot moment, that he is a devout Christian, which is awesome. We talk about that and the role it plays in his life. But probably starting with porn voice operator isn't a great place to start with an individual from that level. But Josh, being the true professional that he is, rolled with it the whole way. And Josh's company is really a cool company. It's a marketing tool, but it's all those crazy little quizzes you take on, like, which princess is your favorite, or which one best represents you, or what's your best muscle, or whatever. Like, these little quizzes. But the idea is that from a marketing perspective, is it increases your mailers. It increases your e-marketing database. And I thought that was a really brilliant take on it. And we actually have a great conversation about him being homeschooled. And as you saw by the intro quote there, that they are a little bit weird or odd, but that's okay. It's all the same. So, all right, today I want to read you another quote from the book coming up, The Crucible's Gift, Five Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity. And today this quote comes from Mr. Hal Movius. Now, Hal Movius is the president of Movius Consulting. He has a PhD. And ironically, and I didn't know this when I spoke with him, his father-in-law, who passed away, plays an integral role in the book, because his father-in-law really wrote the idea about adversity and leadership. And anyhow, I didn't know that till after I wrote the book and did some more research. But this is what Hal had to say. Hal basically writes this: James Kelly brings characteristics, enthusiasm, and curiosity to this fascinating exploration of what helps leaders to succeed and thrive in today's challenging environment. And what I love about that is just the sheer simplicity of the whole thing. And, you know, I talked to Hal about a year and a half ago, and we just kind of hit it off, and I thought I'd ask him to read the book. So you can also find him on my podcast as well. I think it was last fall, 2016, if I recall. So, all right, what else is going on? So there's some books up for pre-sale. Go to Amazon, grab it. It will be available on the 23rd. But as you all know, or maybe you don't know, is that pre-sales are probably the most important thing in a book, for a book. Because that's what gets you out the gate. That's what gets you recognition on Amazon. That's what gets you the as I said, recognition to be up there with the big boys. And so please go out there, pre-order on Amazon. It'll be in the notes. And help this guy out who is trying to make a difference in his life, in his family's life, and make a shift. And we all have nudges in life, and this was my individual nudge. So, all right, go to YouTube, subscribe, listen to this week's vlog. Go to my website, www.drjameskelly, get this week's blog. And I need to update all the interviews on my website, but you can go to iTunes to get all the past interviews. All right, have a great day, everyone. Talk to you tomorrow. See you. All right, welcome to another installment episode / book chapter, whatever the hell you want to call it, of Executives After Hours. On today's show, I have the pleasure to have Mr. Josh Hanum, co-founder, CEO of Interact. How are you, Josh?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Ah, thanks for coming. You have such a radio voice, Josh. I feel like that or you're the guy who's on the porn lines, but I don't want to assume that you're the hold voice in the porn lines, because that seems a bit weird. So,
no, definitely radio.
Okay, go with radio then.
Quite a few of these shows.
That's your expertise. All right, I'm just messing with you. So can you quickly tell my, because I was doing some research about Interact before our phone call, and it's a really interesting concept that you and your organization has come up with. So can you give the 10,000-foot view of what Interact is?
Yeah, so Interact is a platform for creating quizzes like the ones that you see all over Facebook. But the purpose for creating those quizzes is marketing. So companies will work with us and create stuff along the lines of what kind of coffee drink are you, or sometimes it even gets silly and it's which Disney princess are you. But they'll find a way to tie that back into what they sell as a company or the services that they offer. And you're able to filter people into the correct product offerings depending on which outcome they get on a quiz. And the other thing that we do is allow you to use those quizzes to build up your email list. So when somebody has finished answering the questions of the quiz, you can present an opt-in form and get those people on your list. And again, filter them out depending on which outcome they got or how they answered the questions to the quiz. So it's a platform for creating quizzes, which on their face value are pretty silly and just for fun. But once you get into the meat of it and you realize all you can do with the data that people are giving you, answering quiz questions and figuring out who they are as individuals, it really becomes a conversational marketing platform where you are answering people's questions and coming to them where they are as people and offering them the right products or services depending on how they progress through a quiz. So it starts as something that's just for fun, ends with something that's really, really a meaty marketing tool.
So, okay, so you're talking to someone who has spent way too much time doing surveys at some level. So my question I have, and this isn't, I don't know. So is this a scientific method, or is this kind of like a fun method that you are basically driving the consumer into an end question or action item?
Yeah, so it's both, I guess, is the answer. So it is scientific in that.
Just kidding.
It is scientific in that you can get very particular the way these quizzes work. We have a branching system. So if you wanted to, you could get somebody into a very, very specific outcome and then offer them a product or a service based on that. And we've got scoring set up to handle all sorts of implications and things that come in through the questions, right? But at the same time, you don't want to lose sight of the fun aspect, because that's why people take these quizzes. And they're different from surveys in that a quiz has a natural appeal where you get to learn something about yourself. You get to learn what type of coffee drink you are, or what type of business owner you are, or what type of podcaster you are, whatever that is. And it's used as a marketing tool on social media primarily to draw people in. But then you can also use that scientific method. So it's both in that you want to have both, not that it's, you know, crossing lines or anything like that.
And so, you know, because I'm on your website now and I'm trying to like look at it and dive in a little bit. And one of the things that I'm trying to understand is how much of this is preloaded and how much of this is content that I have to provide.
Yeah, so it's really up to you. We have preloaded quiz templates across a variety of industries. We currently have about 150 of those. And those are based off of the best practices that we've learned in each industry and what kinds of quizzes are popular in each industry. And you can simply plug and play with any of those. Or you can start from scratch and build your own complex system as advanced as you want it to be.
And so, because you know, I'm looking at this and you've got giveaways, polls, quiz template, which I'm guessing is making your own quiz there. And so where did this, you know, there's companies like Polls Everywhere. You also have like Qualtrics, which is like a survey type company, but also can do little polls. You have Google surveys, which is also like one or two single items. So where does this idea come from for you guys?
Yeah, so this idea was really born from trial and error. Myself and my co-founder in the company, Matt, used to be web consultants, and we worked with small businesses, helping them build their online presence from their website to their marketing to their email list to their SEO, everything. And all they ever cared about was how many new contacts they got on their list, because that was something that made sense to them. Most of these folks were older. They understood the idea, if I have a list of contacts that I can sell to, I can make more money. And so that was the whole purpose of having an internet presence for them. But a lot of the websites we built just didn't convert very well. I mean, they converted at industry standard rates of 1 or 2%, but that doesn't get you much if you only have 15 or 20 visitors a day. There's just not much coming in. But then one of our clients, who was a sales consultant, asked us to build him a quiz called "What Type of Salesperson Are You?" and put that as basically his homepage on his website. And we did, and instead of his website converting at 2%, it was now converting at 75%.
Wow.
So 3 out of 4 people that hit that page would take that quiz and opt in, and it was so much more powerful than any of the other stuff we'd ever done, and we couldn't ignore it. So we built a platform where anybody can do that, and now we have that template, you know, what type of salesperson are you, in our platform. You can replicate what we did for him in about 15 minutes, connect it up to your email list, and start building up your list of contacts. So it really comes from an old concept of the more people you can sell to, the more sales you're going to make, and you have to have those people on your list. A quiz just happens to be an amazing way of building up an email list.
So how do most people use this? I mean, do they mostly use it on their social media websites or social media mediums, or do they use it on their website?
Yeah, so there's really three main ways. Two are on your website and one is on social media. The two on your website are to set up the quiz to run as a pop-up, which we have built as a functionality in our platform, or as an announcement bar across the top of your site. So you're really using it as a lead magnet on your site. Mm-hmm. Then the third option is to run it as a Facebook ad. And again, we have a tool built in that helps you make those ads and run them to an audience on Facebook to attract new people in. So it's on your website and it's on Facebook.
And so I'm just like, you know, I'm looking at your pricing, which is transparent. You've got the free, which to your credit, you don't really get a whole lot on the back end if you're someone trying to get emails. So it's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And then it goes up pretty quickly to like $17.53, $125. So the question I have, mm-hmm. I guess, is if you're an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. What's the benefit of that, of the light, which is the second tier? Because how many mm-hmm. surveys are you going to actually do in a year that would make that worthwhile?
Yeah, so a lot of times you really don't need to do more than one because you can have that survey or quiz be your lead magnet, because a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of solopreneurs have some sort of method that they're using to trade for email addresses, whether it's a PDF or a download or a resource guide, whatever it is that you have. The object of this is to simply replace that with a quiz and watch your opt-ins oftentimes double overnight just because people like taking quizzes. Whereas, you know, as much as you can claim people love your ebooks, do they really? And that's, you know, no one's ever been ecstatic about posting their ebook results on Facebook. Whereas we have countless stories of people posting their results of a lead generation quiz on Facebook, and they're over the top about how amazing this thing is. But that was a lead generation magnet. Like, when in the world does that ever happen? Mm. And so that's really the concept of it, is it's a way of getting a lot more people from your website and from Facebook to opt in and be excited about what you're doing simply using this kind of tool.
So, okay. So I'm looking at some of the people that use you: Rosetta Stone, Tony Robbins, Michaels, Red Cross, Jiffy Lube, UCLA, and then you put 20,000 plus brands who trust you guys. So I guess my question is, that when did this start, and how fast did you realize that this concept was going to take off?
Yeah, so this started a long time ago in the internet world. It started in May of 2013. Mm-hmm. And we did not realize fast at all that it was going to take off. We had that one example of the guy who had requested it, and we knew that worked. But then we had no idea how to start an internet company. All we knew how to do was sell website contracts, which is really more similar to it is a service industry. So it's basically the same as, you know, selling cleaning services or lawn mowing services or whatever. It's the same concept. Whereas selling an internet marketing platform that's a SaaS product with a subscription, totally different. So we failed pretty miserably at first. We tried to find people on Upwork that wanted quizzes made. We got a couple of them, and they paid us like $200 to build a quiz that took us 2 weeks to make amongst the three of us that were working on it at the time. So we were making like $2
an hour. It doesn't feel very efficient, really, for your time.
It was very, very inefficient. Yeah. And then we started trying to email people to see if they would be interested in using quizzes, and very few of them got back to us. This was before BuzzFeed got popular or any of these internet quizzes. They thought we were talking about school, or if they did get it, they would send us back this laundry list of requests that they needed, which was just insane. And at that time, we were just trying to get people to use it for free. So we were like, we can't do all of these customizations for you. That's crazy. Yeah. That didn't work. And then the last thing that we tried to do, which I'm still hoping this pans out in some way in the future, we started the company when we were at UCLA, and I used to ride my longboard from UCLA over into Brentwood, which is like where the rich people live in LA, and go flyering with like these quiz platform flyers, which I thought maybe like they own businesses and they'd see it. Yeah. And that didn't work.
Also not very efficient with your time.
Nope, that was news. But you, was not a great idea.
But you were riding a longboard, so you were cool as can be.
I felt cool. Yeah. It didn't work. So that's pretty much where we started from. And then the thing that finally clicked it into place was actually just writing about the exact thing we do, writing about how to use quizzes for marketing, how to make quizzes, all that kind of stuff. And that was the basis of where we got into content marketing, writing blog posts about stuff. And from that point forward, we've done at least 1,000 different pieces across our platform and our partner network and other websites. And that's the exclusive thing we've done for marketing to this date. And it's really propelled our growth. Now that 20,000 number is actually closer to 45,000, and we haven't updated it in 9 or 10 months, but that's how quickly it's changed. So it's really, really come along quickly because of content marketing.
So, you know, so I click onto your blog post because that's, you know, what you just said. And I got started thinking right away, how many blog posts can you possibly write about quizzes?
Yeah, so we have this tiered approach to it, which allows us to write a lot more. And I can go on for days about this, so stop me whenever you want to. But basically, it starts with what I call core content. And core content is essentially an owner's manual for your product. For us, that means writing how to make a personality quiz, how to make a multiple choice quiz, how to make a scored quiz, how to make quizzes like Cosmopolitan used to do, all that kind of stuff. Where we're literally writing about how to use our product, essentially, which I fought that concept for so long because I thought that was simple. I was like, why this is not a thing that you should write about. But those posts end up being 1,500, 2,000 words with tons of screenshots and explanations and anecdotes, all that kind of stuff. And those posts drive continual signups into our product because they literally say, here's what this is and how it works and what you can do with it. And we talk about all the marketing benefits of that as well. So that's the core, but those are usually, you know, with any given business, there's not more than 15 or 20 opportunities to write those posts because there's just not that many things. But then the next step is what you do is you take all those 15 or 20 posts and you replicate them by industry. And you can get crazy granular with this. So my favorite example is you can replicate all of those posts, how to make a multiple choice quiz, how to make a personality quiz for vegan food blogs. So how to make a personality quiz for vegan food blogs, how to make a multiple choice quiz for vegan food blogs. And there's so many industries that you can do this with. And the thing is, those posts don't get that much traffic. I think our highest traffic one gets like 5 hits a day, but they continuously drive signups because out of those 5 people, 3 of them click through and start a trial or a free account with us, which is just an insane conversion rate. But it's so specific. And that's where there's a huge opportunity. We've done 150, 200 of those posts that you can just get into every single industry. So,
well, you know what I think is amazing about that, though, and it's actually something you said early on that I totally struggle with. I mean, I'm convinced this is why my blog doesn't really take off, or my vlog or any of that stuff, is that I actually ignore a lot of the simple content because I feel like, well, everyone should know that. That's ridiculous. And
yep.
And it sounds like what you just said is that, no, that's what everyone seems to like.
See, that's the thing, right? And I fought it for so long because I would get to talk to people about quizzes. Some of them would respond even when we were doing email outreach and stuff like that. People would respond and they would always ask me, how does this work? How do personality quizzes even work online? I've seen them, you know, in magazines or whatever, but I don't really get it. And I was always under the impression that that was so simple, but I forgot that I had been working on this day in and day out for a year or more by the time I was actually talking to people. And so I thought it was simple, but to somebody new, it's not. Mm. And those are oftentimes your biggest opportunities, just listening to those questions that people have.
I feel like I struggle with that 100%. Like my wife always says that I'm very good at connecting dots quickly, and I don't need a lot of information to understand something. It's not a comment on my intelligence, because she would also argue the other side of that too. But so for me, in my head, I'm like, well, everyone has to be the same way. Like, I don't need to give you how to create a multiple choice, you know, blog post, because, well, shit, that's pretty common sense. And it's not knocking people, but people actually don't want to think. And that's my point, is that I create, not everyone, I'm making some generalizations here, but I create content that I think that sometimes I'm making you work harder for it than I need to, I think. And that's kind of what you learned, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, as a creator, as somebody that's building things, even if you work in marketing or advertising, you're the type of person that's connecting a lot of dots. You're pulling a lot of things together to create a solid campaign, to create a solid company, solid advertising, whatever it is. And you forget oftentimes that if you weren't in this industry, or if you didn't have that kind of mindset, you would need to start at a much simpler place, and you need to have a lot more explanation being done. And I love the analogy of an owner's manual, because I was just talking with a coworker the other day about how the internet really wasn't a part of people's lives who are over the age of 40, yeah. 45 for their entire developing years. So for them, what they're used to is things like owner's manuals. Every product came with a giant pamphlet because there was nowhere – you couldn't go on YouTube and look up, how do I put this IKEA thing together? You had to go through this owner's manual, and people were very used to reading step-by-step instructions that were very thorough, because the only other option was to call, you know, the support line and be on hold for 3 hours. So these manuals got very in-depth, and people got really good at reading them. And now, once we transferred online, so many things are easily accessible that we've forgotten that's how the majority of people still think. And even younger folks, you know, there's a lot of things that harken back to the idea of an owner's manual. An owner's manual is really, if you think about it, just answers to all the questions you might have when you're building out, you know, a new product or trying a new thing.
So the company's fairly young, I mean, in relative terms. So how fast have you seen it grow from the standpoint of, and you don't have to give me actual numbers, but from like a revenue standpoint, you know, you clearly rely on a subscription model. So have you seen a pretty significant growth? And in that, at some point it's going to plateau. So are you guys thinking about diversifying or adding additional products?
Yeah, so we have seen it grow exponentially the last year and a few months. So we hit kind of a bottleneck our second couple of years in business. We tried to go back to doing direct sales and outreach and things like that, and it completely failed again the same way that it had when I tried it the first time. But then we switched back to an all-in approach to content marketing last January, so it's been a year and 2 months. Since then, we've grown our customer base 5x. And gotten much, much bigger. And it seems as if quizzes are really the way to go, because like I was kind of alluding to earlier, it's not just about the concept of a quiz. It's really about the concept of reconstructing a conversation using the technology of a quiz, so you can then offer up the right products, the right services, the right recommendations, the right content to people based on the inputs they're giving you. And it's not just all about you pushing something forward on people. It's actually them telling you what they want, and then you're responding with your offers. And I think there's a lot more we can do with that beyond just the simple concept of a quiz, but it all kind of comes back to the same question and answer format. So how that plays out exactly, I'm not entirely sure, but the interest in using this strategy is growing, and it always takes a lot longer than you think for things to move from the new idea, this cool new hot thing, over into this is an actual strategy that a lot of companies are implementing. And we are not at that stage where every company is doing this thing. But as long as we can stay out on the forefront of the market, when that day comes, we'll experience exponential growth yet again, even beyond what we've already had.
So what does that look like, being on the forefront?
It looks like a lot of conversations, because when you're building something that's truly new and it's not something people have done before, you have to constantly go through trial and error. And the only way to do trial and error well is to talk with the people who are trying it. So we spend hours and hours and hours on the phone with our users, talking through how they would like to use this, how it should be implemented, all those types of things. Then we go back and build some stuff. And so it's back and forth all the time. And luckily, at this point, we are out on the forefront. So we get to talk with the most advanced marketers and a lot of the most advanced companies that exist just in the world. And we're working with them to figure out what this actually looks like. Because for them, the whole key is using these conversations to personalize their product offerings, their product lines. But there's a lot wrapped up in that. So how do we align with the companies that already exist and the systems that they already have in order to use this tool effectively? And that's really what it looks like day to day.
I think that's amazing, because as you were talking, I was also had another stream of consciousness, which I tend to have a lot of them at multiple times, was here you have this young company that's kind of growing, you know, pretty quickly. How has the dynamics between you and the co-founders evolved?
Yeah, it's really an awesome thing because there's so much stress and there's so many things to deal with and there's so much change that it really requires almost a 1,000-foot view, if you will, to those relationships. And one of our co-founders parted ways early with us, so now there's just the two of us. But over the years, there's been a lot of ups and downs and more recently a lot of ups. But along with that comes this just trust that has to form outside of what's happening day to day and what's going on within the context of each little issue that comes up in the business. And I'd say the most important thing, like any relationship, is that you just work on it, because if you don't, then it just sits there and all of a sudden something big does come up and you don't have this framework or this backbone built up that you can rely on. You don't have that trust built up you can rely on. And that's where I've seen a lot of issues come up in other companies. So I think the important thing is to remember that the company is not all that there is, which is oftentimes easy to forget when things get really into the weeds or there's a lot going on. But it is the number one thing to remember is that that's not the only thing. And you know, the relationship comes first, and that friendship and that partnership is much more important than just whatever client or whatever issue you're trying to solve.
You know, I had a total thought to that and I just lost it. Damn it. I was thinking, because when you talked about the friendship, it actually changed my thought process. There's these two radio personalities out of Australia. So I used to live in Australia for about 4 years, and there's these two guys named Hamish and Andy. And I have a point to this, so just stay with me. And there was an interview of these two, and these are probably the two biggest radio DJs in Australia, and they're only in their just now, I want to say mid-30s, but they've been doing it for 12 years. They started at like 1920, 21 on the radio. But they're the biggest. They're by far the biggest radio personalities, and they're this amazing duo. So in the interview, they said, you know, how do you guys not fight? How do you guys not implode? Because so many pairs, co-founders, at some point butt heads and they just go their separate ways. And in the comment they said was, when we see the tension about what we're doing is greater than our friendship, we'll stop doing that thing together so that we can maintain our friendship. Does that make sense? Mm. Like their friendship is way more important than whatever it is that they're doing at that point. So just, I guess my question from out of that is then, your co-founder, I mean, how long have you known this guy to develop this, and how did this whole thing start with you two?
Yeah. So I've known him for 7 or 8 years now. I'm getting old, so forget how long ago things were. Not actually that old.
Yeah,
but,
I know. You're like mid to late 20s max. I know. Yeah.
Yeah, and 25. Yeah. But still feels old.
But in dog years, you're like 250, so don't worry about it.
I know. I'm basically just good as gone. Yeah. Yeah, so I've known him for 8 years, and we were friends before we started the company. We were actually in a Bible study together, which is how I know him. And we would hang out and do stuff before we actually started the company. And we kind of got linked up because there was a startup event going on at UCLA, and we were both interested in that. And then our other friend looped in, and that's where it grew from. So there was that foundation of, you know, not only do we have the shared friendship, but we have a shared faith as well. And those are things that we can rely on outside of what's going on with the business. So, you know, we'll oftentimes even check each other on like, hey, man, you know, this is getting to be too much, or this certain aspect of the business is not going well. And at the end of the day, our friendship and our faith comes before any of those other things. So if there's a decision to be made, it's always going to be made on the side of the friendship and of our shared faith rather than on what's going to increase the bottom line or make us look better or any of those things. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what can get you in a lot of trouble, is when you keep making those decisions just to increase the bottom line, to make more money, to take advantage of whatever opportunity you have in the short run, and you stop thinking about the future and what's going to really matter and what comes back to your morals and your standards. And I think that's where companies really get ripped apart.
Well, and I think, you know, what's really mature on you, on your behalf, is that often when you're young and you're having success, greed could be one of the first things that infect the decisions you make, right? And the positions in the organization and whatnot. Do you guys have almost like a code word? And that sounds probably weird. Do you guys have almost like a code word that you guys use when you feel like you're off? Or I'm just really interested in this dynamics because you've mentioned this a couple times now. It's like your faith for both of you guys is very strong, which is great. And then you both have a shared vision for the organization, but you can't always agree. So do you guys have a code word or a phrase or a moment or some sign that you guys have where you say, okay, let's take 10 minutes and cool our heads and rethink this or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we call it taking a beat, which is something that I got from my executive coach that is another aspect of all this. I meet with a coach every week for the last 3 years, and you know, he kind of speaks a lot of wisdom into these types of areas. So yeah, we call it taking a beat, which is where if something is really, really tough, like let's say we're facing a financial crisis, you know, it's whatever happened and all of a sudden we're not able to make payroll in a certain month, we don't just try to fix the problem right away. We say, let's reconvene tomorrow. Let's reconvene in a few days, depending on how much time we have here. And we'll think about, you know, the best way to move forward here. And then we go back and each, you know, take our own way of handling it, whether it's through prayer or, you know, talking with somebody else or meeting with my coach or talking with an advisor. And you go back and you go through your method of dealing with it. And then you come back with a more level head. So that's really been big because if you try to just fix everything, it's like you're applying patches everywhere and before long, it all just bursts apart. So you really do have to do that.
So then, you mean, so I guess that begs another question is, and because you're both fairly young, not fairly, you're young. Yeah. Who do you guys have around you to give you sage advice about choices? You have a company that's growing pretty rapidly. You're kind of in this niche space. You work with a lot of big brands. Who do you have around you as your advisors, besides your executive coach, who's kind of talking about you and your personal interactions, but what advisors do you have around you?
Yeah, so in terms of professional, I have a few go-tos that I'll check in with stuff, but that's really more on the strategic side. Yeah. In terms of the stuff that's actually difficult, the one that I end up going to a lot is my older brother, who's 6 years older than me and has his own company and has been in the industry quite a bit longer than I have. So that's a go-to for me. Matt, my co-founder, has family around as well, especially on his wife's side that he'll go to. And we both have our own small groups still. You know, we're not in the same one anymore, but Bible studies that we'll go to and seek wisdom and advice from people that are outside the situation who know us well, and they can see how things are affecting us. And oftentimes that's a more clear indicator of the right choice than even the facts. Just the way that I'll talk about something, and then I'll be sitting there with my brother and he'll just reflect with me on how things appear to be from his side, just on from an outside perspective. And that can be really helpful. It's just like, hey, when you're talking about this option, it just doesn't sound like your heart's in it. When you talk about it this way, that seems like the better way to go. So stuff like that, that reflection has been huge.
So how do you discern, if you go out, because I'm curious about this, right? Like this is something I struggle with. Yeah. So to get your take on it would be fascinating because you seem like you're someone who seeks advice, right? Like you realize you don't have all the answers. So in that means you get lots of opinions. And so how do you discern the opinion to follow or listen to most?
Yeah, I think one of the big things I look at is just actions, because you could say whatever you want, but in terms of the way that you actually live your life, that's what I look at a lot. So
even with business advice?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, and it crosses over into how that person acts on a personal basis, not just how they act in the business world, right? So if I'm getting advice from somebody on how to move my marketing strategy forward, and what they're telling me seems to work, and their company is also growing well, but then I know that person is just a total, you know, just asshole outside of work, I'm much more likely to take that advice and not do anything with it, rather than somebody who I know to be a genuinely kind person who's trying to do the right thing and is making positive impacts on others, and then they give me a marketing strategy that's also working. I'm going to take the one that has the better ramifications overall. So I often take into account the whole picture of who this person actually is and how, the way that they act, rather than just the results they've gotten in business.
That's awesome. So I mean, it sounds like to me the relationship is the most important predictor of whether you're going to take on someone's opinion wholeheartedly. It doesn't mean you always follow it, but take it on wholeheartedly.
Yeah, because, you know, everybody's got their business personas, their marketing personas. You don't know who they really are until you kind of have a deeper connection.
All right. So I have one more question about Interact. I don't know why that's so hard for me to say, Interact. I touched upon this a little bit earlier. Where do you see this company going? Are you guys eventually looking to sell? Are you looking to acquire? Are you looking to just simply grow in the space you're in?
Yeah, I think as I look around at other industries that have been built up, we do-ish. and by ish, I mean that most of them tend to just rip off the things that we build. Like I said, our process for building is very conversational. It's a lot of trial and error with our clients. And so the stuff we come up with is super unique. And then our competitors will just go do the exact same thing. And you know they couldn't have gotten it from anywhere else because we got it from actual like one-off conversations. And so that tends to be what happens. They're innovative in the marketing and sales arenas, so they'll find different avenues of selling the product. But realistically, it's just a kind of follow the leader type of deal. So at this point, there's not a lot in the space that we're truly competing with. We're not going head to head on deals and losing out or anything like that. But there is competition, which means that the space has opportunity for growth. In terms of where I see it going, I really think that we have an opportunity to build a standalone company. My favorite example of a marketing company that's done this well is called Unbounce. It's a marketing landing page platform that's just grown slowly through content marketing mostly. And, you know, they're 12 years in or so, and they've got 80 or 90 people, and they've done just really, really well. I could definitely see a similar trajectory happening for us, where we grow organically through providing good educational content across the board and providing a good product solution that a lot of companies want to use. And from there, who knows, but I definitely see that as the type of company that I would like to run.
Okay, so let's thank you for that. So let's pivot. Yeah. And for the last 15, 20 minutes, let's talk about Josh, right? So where are you originally from?
Yeah, so I am from the Central Valley in California, which is not the California you think of. It's basically like the Midwest. Yeah. It's farm country. I grew up on what used to be an almond orchard, and my friend lived on a chicken ranch. So that kind of thing.
what city is that in that area? What's the closest
big
city?
It's called Turlock.
Turlock. Why do I know that? Why do I know that name? I actually know that city. Why do I know that?
Turlock.
Is there some famous quarterback that came from there or some famous?
Yes. Colin Kaepernick.
Okay.
Colin Kaepernick.
All right.
Lived in Turlock. He's a few years older than me. We went to the same high school.
All right. So what was life like growing up in this? Because you're in Berkeley now, right?
I live in San Francisco now, and our office is in Oakland.
Okay.
So
it almost has to be because of Colin's perspective. So sure.
Yeah. And it's got a nice little kind of creative culture over here that I like. I mean, growing up there, it was really kind of make your own fun is what I would say. It's the type of place where, you know, people who stayed, the number one topic of conversation is how there's nothing to do there. And that's the type of place that it is. So myself and my friends, not only was there not much to do, but we were also all homeschooled. So there wasn't even like people to hang out with. So we would get together, myself and, you know, this small group of friends that were also homeschooled, and we'd build stuff. We would create our own fun. So we built like this network of tunnels in my backyard because there's huge backyards there. So we had this whole network of tunnels. We built tree houses and teeter totters and giant bike ramps and all sorts of cool stuff. And that's really, I think, where a lot of my creative side comes from, is just that you're sitting there, there's nothing to do. And so you go out and you build your own entertainment. And to this day, that carries through. My favorite part of running Interact is when I get to build stuff, when I get to create anything in whatever format that comes in. So that's really what it was like. There was, you know, just a lot of just kind of dull afternoons where you'd get together and just figure out how to create something to entertain yourself.
So talk to me about the homeschooling. You know, we're actually contemplating doing it next year for our kids. And, you know, there is a stigma, whether it's right or wrong, that homeschool kids are always a bit odd, right? And I'm not sure that's true or not. So I don't want to imply that you're odd. You're actually very well spoken and super humble. But you know, from a social standpoint or an activity standpoint, you know, were there things that you felt like you missed out by not going to a traditional school?
Yeah, definitely. And it is interesting because my littlest brothers are 10 years younger than me. So they're just starting high school now. And they were never homeschooled. They went through a traditional school the entire time. And it is, you know, about as good of a scientific test as you can get right there.
Did your older brother end up homeschooling?
He did as well. Yeah. Okay, we were homeschooled through high school, and then we went into public school and high school is how we did it. Okay. And I think it's totally true that you end up odd if you're homeschooled. Odd can play out in a lot of positive ways. Yeah, I mean, inventors are always odd. Like, you look at somebody that creates a new invention and they're probably a pretty weird person. And I think there's a lot of positive aspects to that, where you have that creativity, you have that self-motivation. You know, I'm incredibly self-motivated. I can kind of will myself to do pretty much anything in the business world, even in like the fitness world, anything like that, because that's how it goes. You're handed a pile of work and it's do this. That's pretty much the entirety of your school. There's no like teacher that's standing there all day telling you how to do stuff. There's no small group of people that you're in, and you can't rely on other people to do stuff for you. So you do become really self-motivated and you become pretty creative, I think, because of that requirement where you just have to, you're responsible for everything individually. I think where it comes in as a negative is in the kind of interpersonal stuff. So in terms of working in a small group, that's not something that you have experience with, you know, in terms of getting other people to kind of come over to your side and join your cause, if you will, that's not something you have experience with. So I think there's pros and cons to it. Like, you're going to lose out on a lot of that self-motivation and a lot of that creativity if you're in school all the time because you're not required to do those types of things. But in the homeschool environment, you're missing out on the things where you're, you know, in more of a group environment.
So do you see that in your younger brothers? Like, do you see them? I mean, are you able to notice the differences, I guess? I mean, I don't know if you're too close to the situation.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some noticeable differences just in terms of their inclusiveness of others and that kind of thing. I think they also have a lot of influence from myself and my older brother. And then I have, you know, we have a big family. So a couple other older sisters as well that were homeschooled when they were younger, who all have that kind of self-motivation, that drive. So I think they adopt a lot of that. So in terms of how different they are, it's not vast, but you do pick up on little things here and there where, you know, in a group environment, or they're talking about, you know, how they're leading different groups, or they, you know, they're starting a coding club at their school. Things like that are kind of more outside the realm of my natural
super interesting
skills.
Super interesting. And there, you know, and nowadays, I mean, there are a ton of different homeschools. You know, where I live in the Middle East, there's a lot of families that homeschool their kids, a lot. Because it's quite easy to do nowadays. You can be done in 3 to 4 hours, you know, during the day. And so you're off doing other things. There's a lot of flexibility. So I just think it's an interesting, you know, it's something that we're really thinking about next year. Just from a financial standpoint, you know, we have to spend a lot of money out here to go send the kids to school. So it could be an easy way for my wife to still work and me to still work and the kids to do and save the money, but then also get homeschooled, you know, in 3 to 4 hours. I mean, that's and you're at your own pace. So my son would probably move further ahead in certain areas, and so would my daughter, because it's you're not restricted to a common denominator, whatever that is, right? Mm-hmm. So talk to me about, where did you end up going to university? Was it UCLA, right?
Yeah, UCLA.
So what was that shock like? Because I guess you said you went to high school, a public high school, so you weren't totally blindsided by the social environment. But one of the things that you talk about a lot is the role that your faith plays in you. So was that developed? Was that developed as you were growing up? I mean, was that part of your family structure? And then how did you carry that forward into UCLA, which is, in my mind, at least, a liberal, outgoing, you know, environment?
So, I mean, I grew up fast after, you know, when I was about 15, 16 years old, there was some family struggles, things like that. I became financially independent. And that's when I started my first company, when I was a sophomore in high school. And at that point, I really jumped into that hyper independence, just doing my own thing a lot. And that's also where the faith came from, because I really was on my own. And I think, you know, you talk to a lot of people about, you know, their faith stories. That's kind of where it's born from. A lot of the time is you got, you know, nothing else to turn to. Everything else has fallen apart. And that's the one thing that's kind of just still standing there. It's like the building's falling down. There's this one pillar that's still there. And that's what, you know, God was for me. And that's how I found my own individual faith. And then in terms of, you know, the culture shock of everything, I think there was a bit, but at the same time, I think just having that core value pretty rooted from a young age, it led me to the right people. You know, I made really good friends in college and kind of had my group. And yeah. And I think it was definitely in part because of, you know, finding my way at a young age, and then also having that just really firm foundation of like, this is who I am. I think that, you know, if you stick to who you are, then like-minded folks will, you know, come around. I think where I've, you know, made mistakes is when I try to be somebody that I'm not. And that's where you end up, you know, really feeling out of place, and you end up in situations where things just aren't right. So that, you know, that's kind of how it went through high school and college. This is who I am. And it worked out pretty well.
It's interesting, you say that about when you try to be someone you're not. You know, I actually just wrote a blog post today on this idea called public versus private self, and how many of us have this private persona that we perceive ourselves to be, and the public we try to manage. And what I argue is that, you know, when you're trying to be your most real self or authentic self, you want to stay within 15% of that. I call it the 15% rule. So you have this baseline authenticity that you try to live in, whatever that is for you. You define that. I can't define that. But you try to stay within that 15%, meaning when you're in the public, you might have to turn yourself up. So right now, you're probably more Josh than what you will be in 30 minutes when we're off the call, right? That's just human nature. The problem, what happens is that when that 15% being turned on is 40 or 50%, because it's exhausting for you to be someone else. It's exhausting for those around you to see you be someone else. And it's exhausting for for the people that you work with to see it as well, because they can see right through it. They know it's bullshit. And so it's this idea of trying to marry this public-private self as close as possible so that you maintain a little bit of privacy, but in the same note, you're able to be as true to Josh as Josh can possibly be in all situations, which isn't easy for everyone because we have our own insecurities and we're worried about judgment and things like that. And so I love that you said that.
Yeah, no, I love that way of thinking about it. It's something that I've talked about with my coach in, you know, different terms, where it's inevitable that depending on what kind of group you're with or what circumstance you're in, you're going to adapt. Like, you're not going to be on stage and be the introspective, like, deep version of yourself, because that's just not going to work well.
Because you'll be boring as bad shit on stage. So
exactly, right? But I like that idea of it kind of as an anchor. Like, this is who I am. Yeah. This is my foundation. And then from there, it's almost like one of those like mind maps. There's like little bubbles of, you know, these personas that you take on. You know, if you're on stage, you got to be, you know, more lively. You got to, you know, liven up the crowd. If you're talking to a friend, you know, over a beer, you're much more toned down and you're more, you know, in that introspective space. It just depends on in what environment you're on, but it comes back to this foundation, and that foundation, you know, is really hyper important, because it's what grounds you.
Well, and it's always keeps there. You stable. The key is that you know it's there. I think that, you know, if you go to, if you meet someone in their early 20s, maybe early 30s, who is working on Wall Street making $1 million a year, there's a great chance they're lost. They don't really know who their true self is. And you know, I've been fortunate enough on this podcast to interview a ton of different leaders at different parts of their life. You know, some as young as you, some in their 70s who are retired. And what you find overwhelmingly is those that were able to sort out their adversity, those that were able to define that adversity for themselves and be true to themselves and find their authentic anchor, were the ones who were the most successful, because people gravitate to those individuals. They love being around people who are always consistently the same within that 15%, because it gives them a sense of security, and it allows them to diffuse their public self that might be over that 15%, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reading this book called Into the Silent Land, which is about meditation and prayer. It's written by monks from like a super long time ago. And it's that exact yeah. concept yeah. of the people that are able to ground themselves and go back to, you know, in the context of this book, it's the silence, but the really, what that means really is this foundation, this anchor, this place that you can go and be okay, look at your life from an outside perspective and not let every little thing throw you for a loop, which ties back to being in this mm-hmm. firm foundation that really, really puts you in a much better yeah. mind state. And I think the people that end up not only going far, but also just being truly enjoyable in life are yeah. the ones that have found mm-hmm. what that silent state is, what that foundation is, mm-hmm. and they can hang on to it.
I have a book coming out in April, and that's where this blog post comes from. One of the things I open up with is the fact that we work, and I can't remember the exact number, but it's like 84,000 hours is like mm-hmm. your working life, give or take. And I used averages like 40 years of work at 40 hours a week, you know, at, I think I said 45 weeks a year or something like that. I even gave us the bonus of like a European vacation. And the reality is what I always come back to is, why would I want to be somebody else for even half of that, my working career? Because the level of anxiety of almost being found out would be so far worse than just being found out that you're not perfect and that you have imperfections and that that's okay, because you know what? I'm not good at X, but I'm really good at Y. So let's figure out how we can use my Y and we can support the X. Or if the X is essential, what skills do I need to better the X, you know, while I magnify the Y, whatever those attributes are for you as a person. Because I think that's the struggle that we have in America. And as a young leader, you know, I'd have to wonder, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, how do you balance, and I don't know how many employees you have, but how do you balance the fact that you're only 25 with the need to lead a team?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think it does come down to being known. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a really good quote, I don't know where it comes from, but it's like all we really want in life is to be known and still loved. So for people to actually know who you are, but then still love that person. And I think that is the key to it, to be open about where you have struggles, be open about where you make mistakes, to be open about things that are difficult for you, and just say those things out loud, like, hey, this is difficult for me, but you know, X, Y, Z. And I think if you can get into that state and then let your true colors show through, and then people still want to be part of what you're doing, mm-hmm. that's where you have to be. That's because awesome. Then there's no pressure. Mm. It's like, I have to do this thing. You guys know it's going to be hard for me. And you can just be open about that. You don't always have to be, you know, the knight in shining armor that never makes a mistake. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's all there is to it. Like, you have to be open about your weaknesses and then let your strengths shine through. And, you know, if people are still with you at that point, that's pretty amazing.
You know, it's funny. As you're telling that story about being open, my wife is a personal trainer / triathlon coach. And she works at a gym here. And this is the owner. It's his first time ever owning a business. And man, is he struggling. Like, it's so obvious he's struggling. The power was turned off today. He's always about 5-6 days, maybe even longer, paying the staff. It's not a big facility. It's like 3 employees, 4 employees. He never has any money, and he has pretty good client base. I mean, it's packed in the classes. But what he doesn't do is talk to the team and say, listen, I'm having a hard time right now. Here's what I'm struggling with. Here's our problems. It's not an organization of 100. You have 3 other people in the office with you. And if they can't trust you and know that you're having problems, that they can help you. Like, my wife was a consultant and a senior project manager for 10 years, you know, before her and I got married. She has a skill set, you know. And I think what's great about leaders who really lead is when they say, I need help with X. And you know you've got a great team when they're not judging you for that call to help. And I think that that, to me, again, I hear you talk, and I'm like, man, there's no way you're 25. Like, you've got to be, you've got to be at least my age of 43 or younger. I mean, that's the way I feel about it. You know?
Yeah. You know? I get called out on that quite a bit for being an old man.
Yeah, you're an old soul, which is awesome. You know?
Hey, but I mean, I think that's a perfect point. And, you know, I had this super liberating moment only a few months ago where, now, even though we've grown exponentially, like on every level, we had a financial issue a few months ago where I just hadn't planned well, and it was totally my fault. And I let everybody in on that, let them know we were having a tough time. And to my surprise and delight, everybody rallied around, helped out in whatever way they could. And we got through it. They all helped out, you know, in terms of closing more accounts and pushing invoices through, whatever it was that they could do. And we got through that state, and it really is freeing to not feel like you're the only one that can help solve an issue. And you're right, you know, like your wife, like people have amazing skills that you may not even know about until you say something.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that you have the wisdom, and you probably, you know, people around you have helped you develop that. Earlier you said something, and we don't have to talk about it, but I thought it was an interesting statement you said. You had talked about at 15 you kind of had to start working. So what was it at 15? I mean, clearly that was a question I'm going to ask you. What was it at 15 that kind of shook you to have to take on this more independent role?
Yeah. So, I mean, we just had some family financial issues. There was some things that were propped up for a really long time. And
did your dad own a farm? Is that what it was? An almond farm or?
No, it wasn't anything to do with that. It was more of like a inheritance type of thing, and then family problems that caused that to get cut off. So then I'm at 15, kind of staring at the prospect of like my family's finances are completely unstable, and it was also, you know, right in that financial crash. So for me to go out and get a normal job was out of the picture. I tried to work at McDonald's and all those places, and I'd sit in an interview session with a bunch of guys in their 40s wearing suits. And I was like, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. Like, this is like absurd. Yeah. You know, and then that point, minimum wage was like $7.25 an hour. So it was just a crazy, crazy time. And you know, there was the aspect of my parents trying to figure things out financially, but you know, I was not looped in on that. And so I was kind of out on my own. And then I also ended up moving out shortly after that. So, like at 17, I moved out of the house.
Did you get along with your parents?
Yeah, I did. And I still do. Just kind of, there's, you know, certain aspects of it that didn't go so well for them financially, that put me in that position.
It's sorry, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. So just so I understood, the way I interpret that is that essentially, because the situation was so dire, and this reminds me of, like, you know, the Great Depression, or it actually reminds me of people in the Philippines or India, where they basically say to their kids, like, you got to either go get married and move out if you're a female, like at 17, or the son, you need to go off and work in a foreign country to make money to send home. It was one of these things where, like, it was easier for you not to be there financially for them and you felt compelled to move than it was for you to be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's a fairly similar analogy. I mean, I don't want to, like, discount the extremeness of others' situations.
Sure.
Like, you know, I still lived in a suburban neighborhood and things like that. But it was a similar thing, you know, where if you want to kind of continue living the way that you are, you're going to have to do it on your own. And so that's kind of where that stemmed from. Like, I stopped playing sports and all that kind of stuff and stopped going to school very much and just started working. And so, that's a similar analogy.
Man, I feel like I could ask you a whole stream of questions on that, but I've already had you for an hour. So well timed coming that up at the end for you. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I hope that in 20 years I can ask you this question again, because I want to see how it changes. But Josh, where you're at and what you do, how do you define happiness?
That is an excellent question. And for me, happiness is fleeting, and it comes and goes. And for me, the more important thing is true joy. And for me, joy comes through purpose and having a purpose that I feel is actually meaningful. And the only thing that I've found, you know, I'm only 25, but I've done a lot of things that people would look at and say, wow, like that must make you happy. That must make you cool. And nothing has, other than the pursuit of my faith and what that means for me and how that plays out in my life. That's the only thing that I can turn to and actually brings not only joy, but also inner peace, because it feels meaningful. Whereas all these other things that I've done and I'm getting accolades for are super empty at the end of the day. So for me, that's pretty much all there is to it.